And doing a little research, I found out that Three Dog Night played at least once before at the Surf, and that was in 2006. I was just looking on online concert archives, and I saw you were there.
Yeah, well, 2011, too.
2011,
September.
Too? Yep, I was going to ask if there was any other times that you were at the Surf. And why don't you, can we start out first, talk about the current tour that you're on, and what...
Well, it's an endless tour. We're ending up for, you know, the first couple of months, there was nothing going on, and I think we've got about 87 gigs, so that's a lot of gigs. But lately, the last three gigs we've done, tours where we were out for 4 days, travel day out, get on our tour bus, travel, fly home, home one day, out. Three shows, same thing, over and over, and that's what it's kind of like doing. This is the first time we've been off. We go out on the 22nd again, but like I'm doing, we might be buying another house. Dennis, you know, all of them, mommy do stuff, get my cars fixed. But it's wonderful. I love doing it.
Sure.
I truly, truly love doing it, and the band is doing really well. We've been whatever's going on. We're selling out every place we play. So it's crazy. I think some of them think, oh God, he's so old, he might not be around next year. Everybody's dropping like flies. Bobby Robertson just passed.
Oh, man. Yeah.
One of the greatest guitar players in the world has just passed also.
Do you have any stories of Robbie? Any relationship there?
Robbie, not really.
Okay.
No, I don't have with Robbie.
Okay.
But I admire his writing.
Sure, sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what the 2023 iteration of Three Dog Night looks like, sounds like, and can you talk about a little bit about what we'll expect at the show?
Well, you'll be able to hear it. We have a new album, our first new complete album since the 70s. We're coming out, it's finished, so we're just letting the lawyers do their stuff and all that, and getting the paperwork done. We'll be doing at least one new song from the album. I love the set we're doing now, and I feel like with an album coming out, I would rather put the album out and see what kind of hits, what the songs, you know, the public like the best, if they hopefully download some of it. And then we'll put those into the set. We've always felt that it's important that the public pick the singles, not us. I think our first single we picked and it did nothing. but then we had top 40 and then a number one on the first album. But we learned our lesson not to try to outguess the public.
Customer's always right, huh?
Oh, well, that's why they're there, you know. People are come to see us. I would say 70% of them for memories, you know. And everybody kind of uses the word nostalgia as a dirty word. But nostalgia originally means coming home. And it's like I remember exactly the moment in my car when I heard Little Richard, and that's all I can think of. I remember the exact spot where I was, and I think that happens to a lot of people when they hear our songs. And we sing the songs in the same key, nothing's changed, and we're on all cylinders, and I think we're as good or better than we ever were live. Because of all, you know, the sound systems now and all of that stuff also.
That's terrific. That's great. Talking about your influence with Little Richard and that memory that you have, if I'm correct, if I'm doing the math correct, you would have been about 17 or 18 on the day the music died in 1959, and the Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper all left the Surf Ballroom and then met their fate. Do you have any memory of this event, or?
Oh yeah!
And
what's his name from the doo-wop group was on that, on Dion was on that, and they flipped the coin, I guess. Mm-hmm. And and he actually won because he lost the coin flip.
Yeah, yeah,
he would have been on the plane. And you know, I know it's so naive of me. I did not realize American Pie was the plane.
Yeah.
And if so many people, including myself when I was younger, just thought that it was about American Pie. You know, it could have been about, you know, the American system in the public.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just a great, it's a great vibe to that place. Everybody should go to it.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, whether you to see a show, just to be in the building. It's so historical. It's wonderful.
Yeah, this is my second conversation about the Clear Lake, the Surf Ballroom today. I talked with a gentleman from England who is in a Big Bopper documentary. He's attempting to get Big Bopper inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for a number of years now. And
yeah.
They just made a movie about it. It'll be at the Iowa Film Festival here, also in Clear Lake, later this September. So a lot of Clear Lake, a lot of surf ballroom history happening around. Can you tell me what made you want to become a musician? Was it Little Richard hearing him?
Oh no, I'm from Ireland.
Yeah,
and I came to America when I was five with my mother, brother, and sister. And then there were a lot of my grandmother was an invalid, so my mother was the youngest. So all the other sisters and brothers all went to America and got along well. So we came over last. So they're all established. So monthly, we would all have these big nights, and you would all go, everybody would go to a different relative's house, and you had to sing. You had to sing. You had to play an instrument. You had to dance. You had to recite a poem. You had to do something, and that was the start of all of that. That's just my one uncle was in the Irish Guards. You know, he guarded the Queen. You know, the big bear hats,
mm-hmm.
the you know, big red coat, and he played about seven instruments. He was just a really wonderful, and you just kind of pick up. As you go along, I was the shyest one. I used to just hide under the table and not do anything at first. I just watched everybody else perform and sing. But that was the start of it. And then later on, I bought an acoustic guitar and I kind of started taking classical guitar lessons. And then, my family, we moved to Hollywood. My mother didn't ever say, let's go to Los Angeles. She said, we're moving to Hollywood. So just my mother and I alone came on the train from Boston, sitting up the whole way to quote Hollywood. And so I was in Hollywood when I was about 12. So I really got, you know, right under the Hollywood sign. Actually, this is early 50s. So I just, when Hollywood Boulevard, you could see Fred Astaire walking down the street. Spike Jones, all these very famous people. It was a wonderful, magical time.
Sure, sure. That's great. Can you tell me how Three Dog Night was formed and discovered?
Well, it was me. I formed the group.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for Hanna-Barbera Records in the A&R department.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to make. I never performed live, so I was in the studio all the time, and I'd make a track, and then I would I'd write the song, and then I would. Put on all the lead and all the harmonies, and then they would find a band somewhere. You know, this is when Hanna-Barbera, the Flintstones, when they wanted yep. To expand into top 40 radio, and they would find a band, the local band, and release the record. Let's say up in Washington State, and the band would play, would lip sync my record. And we'd come up with a name for the band, and it started that way. And then finally, one day I came in, I finished the record, and they went, "We're gonna release this as a single." and you're the artist. And I said, I'm not, I don't do live anything. And they said, yep, you are. They put me on the Dick Clark Show and then on the Sonny and Cher tour. I was on, first time I ever played to a big audience was 5,000 people. And I did five songs with my acoustic guitar and the band behind me, and the band backing me up had a great singer in it, Corey Wells. So when I get back from tour, I produced, they were called the Enemies. I produced them, on a record called Hey Joe, which I did in a set, which ended up, Hendrix doing it, but I did it, right after Tim Rose, the guy that wrote it, and then I just told Corey, I kept him in my head. I said, this guy is a great singer, great blues singer. I ended up meeting my, I went from Hanna-Barbera Records to MGM Records with Frank Zappa. And my manager got me into MGM Records. And then finally he phoned me up one day and he said, look, I've quit MGM Records. I'm now the president of Brother Records, which is the Beach Boys. So why, I want you to come up and meet Brian Wilson. So I went up and we became fast friends. He's one of my best friends to this day. I was best man at his wedding, and he came to my wedding and all that kind of stuff. Then I phoned Corey, and then we auditioned the other singer, Chuck, and I brought them to Brian, and Brian produced us, and he called us Redwood. That was the name he came up with. And then the Beach Boys, and he wrote a song for me called Darlin', because I used to say that a lot for whatever reason. Hey, darling, what's going on? And the Beach Boys came back from tour, and especially Mike was really upset about. He said to Brian, "That's a hit song, Brian. Who are these guys?" But I would have done exactly what he did. He was not wrong at all, and we understood. So then our management said, "Okay, look." Then the Beach Boys overdubbed it, and Carl sang lead on it, our track. And they had a hit with it. So our manager said, go and get musicians and turn your, don't, you don't want to be a vocal, three vocal guys, become a group. And long story short, that was the beginning of Three Dog Night.
Yeah. And that studio system back then, it was sure everybody was sharing everything around, and they were, there was a lot of inspiration being shared. Brian Wilson, wow, that's.
Yeah, I was there for the Pet Sounds album. Mm-hmm. I was there at Brian's house. God Only Knows, which is Paul McCartney's favorite song in the world. I was there while he did the whole track.
Wow.
I learned a lot in Three Dog Nights. You can kind of hear some of that, a lot of you know, vocal stuff.
I can hear a lot of the vocal, the vocals and the arrangements, the wall of sound kind of, definitely is, is visible there.
The new album, where you hear that, we have an a cappella song we do, and it's, we're really proud of it. We'll probably do that, at the coming up show.
Okay. Probably. I got a probably. That's pretty good. I hope to hear it. Prayer for the Children is what you're talking about?
Prayer for the Children. But you got to hear it live. The thing is, I think when people hear that stuff, they don't know how it was produced or whatever. When you hear us just singing live, you have to pull it off. We pull it off. We get a standing ovation every night with it, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm. So your three number one hits are Mama Told Me Not to Come, Joy to the World, and Black and White. And those are all covers. Randy Newman is one of my...
They're all Resurrections.
Resurrections, tributes.
Here's the difference. They were all songs that had been put out on albums and failed. I mean, they never became singles. Mm-hmm. And I always say, we didn't cover a hit. Well, maybe we covered title 10 in this on the first album, but not we were just doing it because Otis had just died. Mm-hmm. And you keep in mind, it's funny. Title Tenderness was a cover of a Frank Sinatra song.
Yep.
From the 40s. So covers can, people just got, well, they just covered it. Now we resurrected it, rearranged it, did it differently, and that's, I think, a real good thing. Richie Potter, the producer, Bill Cooper, the engineer, are wonderful, and that's what I kind of did. A lot was the studio. The guys, the other two guys were like singers for you, singers, and I was a studio guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd usually go home, and we would spend days sometimes mixing and changing things and editing and moving stuff around. And that, and those days, they had big tapes, and you couldn't push a button and move stuff. You had to, with a razor blade, cut out pieces of tape and physically move them to another part of the song. So it was a whole different kind of a way to do it. It's a lot easier now.
Yeah, cover. Yeah, I've been in a cover bands before, but it is kind of a dirty word. You're right, because it tends to belittle.
It sounds like you're imitating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, but we
used our songs. By the other people that we did the songs, we didn't imitate. We changed it all. Mm-hmm. We changed them around.
Interpreted, correct? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I just have to ask about the Randy Newman Association, because he's one of my favorites. Who would you say is the greatest American songwriter?
Oh, Brian Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're talking about in history,
yep.
we'd have to go back to. Brian's idol is da-da-da-da, Gershwin.
Mm-hmm.
Gershwin would probably be one of my favorite writers.
Sure.
But all in all, I think Brian, to me, they throw around the word genius. But Brian, the Beatles, I love the Beatles. I was a big fan of the Beatles, am. But Brian could write the song, arrange the song, sing the song, and produce it. He could do every aspect of a song.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean it in a bad way, but now, you see some of the younger people, and it's a lot easier for them, and they can tune it if you're out of tune and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of stuff you'll see that those people, my song that I wrote, and then you look and it's four writers. I don't know, Madonna, I don't want to be disparaging. She's an incredible business mind. God, wow. She knew exactly what she wanted. There's no one to better than herself telling people what to do. <It's> like, no, this is what I want to wear. This is what I want. You're an influencer. So she's got her talents too. But on pure musical level, I think Brian's the best. I admire Dylan very, very much
mm-hmm.
as a writer. But I think he's not into the studio stuff at all. He's one who likes to do two takes or three takes. And the only thing that disappoints me the last time I saw Dylan is he's so hyper and as far as not wanting to do a song the same way. Wants to change. He's bored. He gets bored.
Sure.
But the last time I went, after three songs, I said, "What?" And then I finally went, "Oh my God, that's a song I love." And it didn't even sound like it. He changed it so much.
Well, he changes himself. He changes himself so much.
yeah. But I admire him tremendously.
Me too.
He's what a wonderful genius. He's very, very literate. Very, very. Very together.
It was cool to learn that Rod Stewart and the Faces opened for you at the Atlanta Stadium in 1972?
Cotton Bowl.
The Cotton Bowl. Okay, Texas Cotton Bowl. Yeah, and you were one of the first acts to be able to sell out stadiums. You know, after
we've been written out of history. It was the Beatles, and then us. Mm-hmm. The stadiums with the big screens, and then Crosby, Stills, and Nash did a tour after us. But we were the first stadium act. Yeah, after them. But remember, we had Leon Russell opening for us, and I can't remember some of the other ones. But yeah,
that kind of shocks me too, because at that point, you know, live music would be kind of at its infancy. They'd only just figured out after the Beatles and Chase Stadium and that kind of stuff that how to correctly amplify everything.
Yeah, there's sound systems.
And those are all three-part harmony groups that you're talking about there, you know.
Yeah.
So they open for you. Talk about your opening act on this tour, Jay Saros. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, he's a young songwriter. Yeah, just acoustic. We're just doing basically an evening with Three Dog Night, or we'll have someone like Jay or another young guy that we'd like to help get started. And very, very talented guy and a sweetheart. But that doesn't require our techs to have to set up a whole another band. Sure. In front of our rig, which is a pain. We usually do the show, leave in the evening, and then leave at midnight and go 300, 400 miles to the next gig. I get into the hotel in the morning, and I don't need to have breakfast. I just usually sleep all day and do the same thing again. And I love. We just have a new bus. Call her Pearl, and they were saying, what colors do you want to make? I said, I'm 80 years old. I don't want a bus with flames. I don't want any of that stuff. So then they showed me the picture. It was a white bus, and I, you know, pearl white, and I thought nothing on it. I love it. You know, you could put a red cross, you know, red cross on it, like it was a medical.
But not your face on the side of the bus. That's you're over that.
Yeah.
I was also interested to learn that in 72 you were on the inaugural New Year's Rockin' Eve, and in fact, it was called Three Dog Nights New Year's.
You
Rockin'
got
Eve.
It. That's... And Dick changed it to Dick Clark's Rockin' New Year's Eve.
Who even ever heard of Dick Clark?
No, but we did that.
Can you share Al Green about that?
Yeah, Al Green was on that.
Wow.
Who else? Rick Springfield is on it. Open. We headlined, and the girl singing the song. What's the song? The woman, black singer. Breaking my song. What the hell
is
it?
Is it Minnie Riperton?
No.
Okay. I didn't figure that out. I don't.
Killing herself with my song or his song.
Killing Me Softly. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, Killing Me Softly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was on it too.
Yeah, that's great.
Roberta Flack. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, she's on.
That's some pretty early.
Oh, wait. The Beach Boys. The Beach Boys were on it. Well, I remember Dennis was backstage. I'm trying to think.
Wow.
His voice is all, he destroyed his voice by that time. He had a rough time. He was a sweetheart. I liked Dennis a lot. Crazy, young, handsome man. Yeah.
Well, that's some pretty early live TV experience. I mean, that's a threshold, you know, that that's in music history
The Queen, but we were in the Queen Mary.
Wow.
Yeah, the Queen Mary, the ship.
Oh, they did the feed from live from the Queen Mary. That's so cool. That's really neat. So I found out one of your sons was the drummer for Haim.
Oh yeah, Haim.
And your another son has been in the music industry for a while now as a producer and a bassist.
Yeah, he's playing with us.
He's playing with you. He's your bass player for the.
He's fabulous.
That's great.
Yeah, and he also he plays with buddies with Mark McGrath, so he plays with Sugar Ray and a bunch of other groups.
Wow. You said in working at Hanna-Barbera Records and other record companies, working behind the scenes a little bit in the music industry, what's a piece of music or a project that the public might not be completely aware of your involvement or that's totally secret that you might be able to share with us? What's a piece of music that you've worked on that not a lot of people would know?
Well, Little Feet, one of my best friends, Lil' George. You know Little Feet?
I haven't heard of that, no.
Oh, you haven't heard of Little Feet?
No, well,
oh, okay. I've sung on his album with "Don't Let the Sun Shine Out." Yeah, Elton, you know, I helped Elton get. I took him to his first restaurant in L.A. When he started. We did "Lady Samantha," one of his first songs, and helped him pay the rent. So it was a big part of him. We were in England, and that's where I met him. And then I invited him to a club called The Revolution. And he couldn't, after the disappointment, he wasn't there. And the bodyguard said, the bouncer said, oh, he's that gentleman's downstairs. He wasn't on the guest list. So I went down and, that's when we really bonded. And then I had him invited him to another club, and I said, to be sure, you come in with us. So he came in with us as a roadie. Reggie Dwight, the roadie.
Yeah, Reggie.
yeah. So, I'm very fond of him. Stuff like that.
Well, he's on a never-ending tour as well.
Yeah, well, he says he's going to end, so we'll see. I can't see him doing that, but I'm sure in his head he's thinking that, but he's going to miss it.
If someone who loves it as much as you do, I'm sure, you know.
And I'm on other albums on the fellow who just died, the guitar player.
Right.
Beck. No, no.
Oh, okay.
Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
I was on. Actually, they almost was going to go. Beck Bogart and the PC. They're looking for a lead singer, really. So I was on one of the songs, but they were thinking about me singing with them. So yeah, I've done a bunch of everything. But oh, Randy, by the way. Van Dyke Parks. Do you know Van Dyke Parks is producer?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, he co-produced his first album, Randy's album. So I was at that session. I was at Randy's session. That's where I met him with Van Dyke.
Well, I love asking famous people who the most famous person they've ever met was, and we've talked about Randy Newman and Brian.
Well, I'll
Brian
tell you,
starstruck you the most?
Oh, by far, you've heard of Laurel and Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Stan Laurel.
Oh, wow.
I met him. I found him. I was reading a magazine, and this was like in 61, 62. I had the postcard, actually, that he sent back to me. And it said that this is, you know, obviously the movies were all done by then, but they were starting to do cartoon things on him.
Okay.
So people started to become aware, but it was a down period. So it said he was retired living in Santa Monica. I got the Santa Monica phone book. Telephone book, and his name was in the book. So I phoned him, and he invited me over to his house, to his apartment. So on the facing the beach. So I spent the whole day with him telling me stories.
Wow!
And it was just amazing to me. he was like, I couldn't believe he was like God.
Mm-hmm. Immigrating to Hollywood, you have any other Hollywood specific stories? You mentioned Fred Astaire.
I was in Milwaukee, Music City, and they had the listening booths then. Mm-hmm. So you could take two or three 45s in there and then play them. But then you had to bring them back and give it to the guy, and he'd check you back out. And I was in there, and he just kind of didn't dance, but he was so graceful. Then he just walked by me. I thought, wow, that's insane. That was another one of those people that did that to me. And you're too young to know. I was my mother worked in this cafeteria basically, and I was washing dishes in there. So I ended up meeting a guy named Earl Leaf, who used to write in all of the teenage magazines, you know, 18 and all of that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And he took a liking to me and all that. He invited me over to his house. Do you remember the Donna Reed show? Have you heard of the Donna Reed show?
I've heard of Donna Reed. I didn't know she had a show.
A TV show. And her daughter in the show was Shelley Fabres.
Mm-hmm.
She actually did a song called Joni Angel that was a hit. And I ended up dating her and taking her to my high school football game. There's a movie called The Bad Seed. You ever heard of The Bad Seed? A very famous movie. There's evil little girl in it named Patty McCormick. Patty McCormick.
Is that William Friedkin?
Well, I knew Friedkin real well. I used to hike with him, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Boys in the Band.
Speaking of Hollywood.
I was on that set. Boys in the Band in New York. I was on that set.
That was
him.
William Friedkin. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, Bill Friedkin.
Yeah.
I got to think about this. But I was a Hollywood guy. Went to grammar school with the girl in the Musketeers, Doreen Tracy, and who else? I don't know. I'll think of 20 people when we hang up.
Oh, sure. Yeah, my grandma worked, my great uncle worked at Desilu Studios.
Yeah.
He was a veterinarian there. My great uncle worked on Mr. Ed. He was one of the veterinarians for Mr. Ed.
Great.
Yep.
Well, I initially worked at the Disney Studios in the animation depot, which is across the street,
mm-hmm.
but they used to load and unload albums there. You know, trucks would come in, and I would get, you know, my put them on pallets and all that stuff, and that's how I started. But they were filming Mary Poppins, so I used to go over at lunchtime every day to the sets of Mary Poppins, which is, and Walt would be come by once in a while with a glass of scotch and a cigarette.
Well, we were talking about for about a half an hour now, but can we wrap it back up to Three Dog Night? And
sure.
There's been a lot of musicians coming and going, and I am sure that the spirit remains, that the Three Dog Night sound really translates.
That's my intention. I started this baby, and I would not be doing it if we didn't have the chops. Everybody is killing it. I'm serious. It sounds crazy. I sing higher now than I did when I was 26. I used to smoke two packs of cigarettes a day. And you notice Elton and Billy Joel, all those guys, they all lowered their songs,
yeah, sure.
The keys of the songs.
Yep.
And they're wonderful singers, but when you change a key in a song, the guitar player's chord has got to be different on the neck.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same sound. It's not like that thing of if you're a cover band. Most cover bands don't do it right because they don't really. They almost get the chords right,
mm-hmm.
You play a C or whatever chord you're playing, but you can play it 8 different ways unless you know how the guy played it on the record. it's not gonna quite sound like the record.
Yep, especially with a band like yours, with the three-part harmony being so integral to how the dynamics of the song are.
And the timbre of your voice. Everybody mm-hmm. has a certain voice, and mm-hmm. you know, like the Bee Gees, who I think are just wonderful, wonderful. Your brothers, they genetically had an actual animal sound that mm-hmm. the you know, the brother, that blood thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, should I ask you what makes a great rock and roll band?
Songs. Without songs, there's nothing. If you think about the jazz players, all of these different players that are fabulous. If you don't have a song, it's just a musical exercise. Yeah. You know, that's all it is. It's just wonderful, well played music. But and obviously, having hits, that's what you need. But a hit, and it's funny, a hit can be some kind of goofy song that's not even a good song, but it's something captures everybody's imagination. But in general, you have to have a great song, and then after you have the great song, you can be a pretty good singer. I mean, Dylan is an interesting, very different singer, but I wouldn't call him technically a great singer. But his songs are wonderful, his lyrics are wonderful, and his voice is unique. So that's one way to do it. And then there's nowadays I hear a lot of songs that I would call producer songs. The producer made it so interesting with the sounds, and sometimes it almost can be like a nursery rhyme. If you played it on a piano, there's nothing, you know, it's just silly. But producers can do that. But in general, if you can play a song on a piano or a guitar and it's interesting, then that's a sign that there's something interesting about it. It's good.
That's great. I'm so excited to help welcome you back to Iowa. On Saturday, the 26th, you're going to be playing at the Surf Ballroom, historic in Clear Lake. There's tickets still available. And I'm very excited to take some pictures and cover the event for the Globe Gazette for you.
That's going to be great. You can have a beer with us afterwards.
Great. That's terrific.
By the way, are you into punk at all? Were you?
I'm sorry?
Were you into punk at all?
Into punk? I'm 30 years old, so I escaped the punk.
Oh, okay, because I manage a group called Fear.
Oh, great.
Which you should see the movie. It's called The Decline of Western Civilization. Mm-hmm. And they end the movie. I couldn't get them on the major radio stations because the words are so many swear words. So then we stopped working with each other, and they went on to Saturday Night Live and destroyed it, the show, and we're banned.
Wow.
From ever being so you should check them out.
Lee, I should.
Good.
We're great. Thank you so much, Danny Hutton, for talking with me today. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to the show.
All right, Alex. I will see you there, and we'll have a beer together.
Sounds great, Danny. Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Have a
okay.
great day now. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Well, I just got offered to have a beer with Danny Hutton after the Three Dog Night show on Saturday, August 26th, 2023 at the historic Surf Ballroom. Doors open at 8 p.m. and there's still tickets available. That was a pretty neat conversation. I had never spoken with a rock star before.